So they gave me an advance. It took me a year to write it. And last Christmas, I remember Christmas morning, I woke up at 4 before the babies got up because the first draft edits were due January 1st. No. And so I would put the babies to bed. And there's a picture of us driving back from my mom's, I think on Christmas Eve or Boxing Day or something. And I've got my feet up on the dashboard and I've got papers on the side where I'm editing and the kids are in the back. Like, yeah. I'm like, be quiet. Trying to figure out how to feel seen. Okay.
You know, shut up so I can feel seen.
You know I'm working here. Like, it's Christmas. I'm like, I know.
Oh, Lordy. Are you all ever in for a treat with this one? I'm Linda Sievertson. This is the Beautiful Writers Podcast. And that was Dr. Jodi Carrington, one of my soulmate clients, a national bestseller, and one of my favorite people on God's green earth. As you're about to learn, Jodi is a self-publishing superstar, currently touring for her new book, Feeling Seen, Reconnecting in a Disconnected World, her first with a top 5 publisher. I call Jodi Canada's Brené Brown, but she's all Jodi. Think of her as your new best writing girlfriend who gives it to you straight. We cover so many things you need to know to sell a crap ton of books while having the time of your life doing it. I'm talking 20,000 copies in your first month, spurred by a supersonic pre-order campaign that apparently I told her to do. That's what's so much fun about producing these 2 self-publishing episodes. The previous one with Hal Elrod, I'd forgotten so many of the magical details of our work together. It's as if I'm discovering our formulas for making millions via self-publishing right along with you. But that's what happens when you do this for decades and have hundreds of clients. Shit escapes out the hole in your head. That's a reference to my chat with Jenny Lawson and Laura Belgray, which also just dropped. You can listen to that one after this one. Okay, more about your new BFF, Dr. Jodi, who believes we're never meant to do any of this alone. Oh, and warning, we both use swear words in this episode. Big surprise, right? You may not guess by her potty mouth, but Jodi's a revered psychologist, the one schools bring in to handle the toughest cases. As a first responder who goes in after the school shootings to soothe hearts and minds, Jodi is fearless with the softest center, as her 3 children and farmer husband would attest. You'll come to this episode for her motivational business savvy, but stay for how she melts your heart. In this episode, Jodi and I talk about her huge-mungous pre-sales for her first book, Kids These Days, a game plan for reconnecting with those we teach, lead, and love. We hash out the perils of audiobooks, and I didn't even know mine wouldn't be out by the time this aired. Oh my God, delays, delays, so much to figure with a book of this size and celebrities involved, but it's coming, hopefully by the end of the year. Jodi shares why she'd never want to start her publishing career any other way than self-pubbing. She shares priceless info on how to build a speaking platform, when to write mass market versus niche, and why you must show up in person for your people when times are tough. To summarize Jodi's work in one line, it's that in the end and the beginning, all we want is to know we matter. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? This is such a gift from the universe. I get you twice in 1 week.
I feel the same way. So how's touring going so far? Are you exhausted? You look great.
Yeah. So we officially kicked the tour off tomorrow, but I head to Toronto tomorrow. We were just in Salt Lake yesterday and just doing some other things with schools and some speaking gigs and stuff like that. And of course, talking all about Feeling Seen, but it's just been so fantastic. My twins turned 10 today, so we had to come home. We flew on 3 different airlines yesterday to get here for 24 hours. I'm going to parent and frolic in the 10-year-old bliss that is children tonight. And then we're on a plane tomorrow.
Thank you for making time for us, for me, for the podcast, my pod listeners.
Beautiful writers of the world. Well, I've talked about this with you many times. You are single-handedly responsible for the self-publication success that has then led to a major publishing deal. That's my journey. I learned so much from you. So I am forever indebted into your wisdom, because this book writing thing is a lonely, thankless, isolating process. And I just found such a home in that. First of all, when we went to the retreat, I loved being in person. And it's certainly what I talk about in Feeling Seen all the time, is that we're never meant to do any of this alone, including writing a friggin' book.
Because dude, it's so hard.
It is. People don't talk about that. I'm going to go write a book. Yeah, you go write your book and see how you come out the other side.
I know. That's why I wanted to write Beautiful Writers, because I thought so many people hear me talk to Brené Brown or Glennon Doyle or these people that we all worship, the Terry McMillans of the world, but they don't hear often, because who's got the space unless you make a whole book about it? They don't often hear about the day-to-day insanity of it and the grind and the crazy stuff that we all do, the embarrassing things we do, the networking fails, the agent abysmal process. There's so many funny, quirky, embarrassing things that happen. And I just couldn't wait to reveal that stuff. I had so much fun doing that. And let me ask you, I don't know you to be anything but just masterful. I watch you on stage and you're masterful. You're funny as hell. You swear so brilliantly and beautifully that people who don't even like swear words love it. You add that perfect balance of research and world experience and intuition and heart. You've just got this amazing blend. But I'm guessing you've done some embarrassing things, or I'm guessing you've had some networking fails or something.
Oh my God. Here's the interesting thing. When you are pushing the envelope, and I feel like this all the time, like people have told me, and this is getting a bit cliche, but you're too much, you're too loud, stop talking like that, you can't act like that, you're a psychologist, that's not how we do things. And I think that that's been the hardest piece for me, and maybe is for everybody, I'll make that guess, is that you can be so self-assured and steadfast in the way that you think and your ideas and what you think about things, and it just takes one whisper and it feels like you fall like a house of cards. And I am shocked by that, because when I'm surrounded with my people, when we're having these conversations, when I know to the core of me that my babies, I'm showing them how to do it, that I'm learning and unlearning and having these hard conversations. And then I think, yes, okay, we're good. It's good. I'm feeling good. This is what we need to do. And then there's one breath, like there's 99 rowers and one breath. And you're like, is it? I'm over. Fuck you. I'm out. This is you. Who did I think I was? Come on. And so that's the part about writing vulnerably, putting it out into the world. We talked a lot about self-publishing, you and I, over these last 5 years. And you were the one who encouraged me really at the beginning, because I had a bit of a small speaking platform that we had developed. There was no, take that risk and put your own work out there, because you kind of have a little bit more control over it in that way. There was never a question whether I would read my own audiobook. There was never a question whether I could say whatever the fuck I wanted to. And what are the ramifications of that? And of course, the biggest issue is the distribution and all those things. But I'm so grateful I went through that process first. And I don't know how people just jump into a major publishing deal any other way these days. You got to be really good and have had established yourself some way. But this process of self-publishing is just such a, and it's many people's end game, but for me, it was such a good training ground to be like, oh, that's what that means. That's why you do things like this. Oh, people, you need ISBN, what news or that is.
Right.
Why do independent bookstores matter? All of those things.
I think self-publishing in your example was spot on, because if I remember correctly, when you came to Carmel, you said to me, it was the fall, I think, of 1 year. And the next winter, like in February, you had this big gig where you were going to have 5,000 butts in the seats. I knew that you would have this ready, waiting, excited audience to buy whatever you have, because I had seen back years ago when I started helping Rhonda Britton, before she had all her big books and before she went on Oprah and won an Emmy for a TV show. We were working on the proposal for Fearless Living. I went to some of her speaking gigs and I was floored at how she would be up on stage speaking to a group. It didn't matter how big. At the end of the gig, those people lined up en masse at her table to buy whatever she had. And sometimes all she had was a little pamphlet, or she had taken the previous speech and put it on a cassette and they would buy the cassette.
Yeah.
But I learned that the audience feels so bonded to you when you're on stage and they love taking a piece of that speaker home with them. So I meet you. I see this bigger than life energy. You were rocking every meal we had. The gals at the retreat were so in love with you. And I thought, oh, holy Moses, this woman is going to be bum rushed at her table. People are going to want whatever she has. And I thought, we need to have a lot of books right then. Did I even tell you to write a proposal?
Yes, you did. You made me go through that friggin' process. And okay, so let me just back up in terms of why we start, how we started this process. Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember. Okay.
I said, when I started speaking and people were like, do you have a book? Do you have a book? Do you have a book? And after I finished my dissertation, I was like, I'm never writing anything again because I don't like it. I like to speak so it. Hard. I like to say it. I don't like to write. Right. Now, I think I'm a decent writer, but it's not my favorite thing. I would rather just tell you than write it. And so when people are like, do you have a book? Do you have a book? Do you have a book? And I was like, oh my gosh. So I Googled how to write a book because I don't know. Who knows? I don't know how to write a book. So I Googled, and then Book Mama came up first and the writing retreat came up very early. And of course, obviously you have to go to Carmel. Obviously you have to go for a week and you need to learn how to write a book. And so I presented this to my husband, who is a farmer. We got everything on a spreadsheet. We are very tight. We need justification for everything. Yeah. You wouldn't know, but it's the end of the world. Yeah. And so I say to him very gingerly, pick my time. I'm like, hey, I was just reading this thing. I really think that I need to write a book. And he's like, that would be amazing, honey. You've never written anything. I'm like, I'm aware. I said, I think that this is the answer. This is how you do it. You have to go to Carmel and you have to stay for 5 days and you have to immerse yourself in people who know what they're doing. And then they just launch it. And he's like, oh, okay. Wow. A week. And I was like, Yeah. And he's like, how much does it cost? And I told him, and he's like, oh my. No. And he's like, that is not happening. And so then I said to him, you've just killed my dream. And I locked myself in the bathroom.
Oh my
and
God.
20 seconds later, I got a text. And I was like, clearly he's like, I'm sorry, honey. I can see you're the talent in the family. That's not what the text said. The text had a very, what is the word? Autographical order. What is the word?
Alphabetical
order. Jesus. You know, the order. Alphabet. Yeah. Why is that such a hard word? Look at me. Apparently I can't speak either. Anyway, in order, showed me all the free writing groups in the greater Calgary area. And I was like, you are dead to me. So then it took me 2 weeks to convince him, and bingo, as I always do in our marriage, I won. And up to Carmel I went, and it was such a beautiful experience for me in so many levels. I am not woo-woo, and in flows Linda with her friggin' headscarf and burning shit. And I was like, what in the... I'm from Alberta, Canada. Why are we lighting shit on fire? And by the end of it, I'm in my room fucking praying and doing things like, this is amazing. This is what you do, right? And I met the most beautiful souls on the planet, all of whom I would have never, ever had the opportunity to cross paths with. Three of them I still stay in touch with. This was 5 years ago. Biggest congratulations from this week. And she's my biggest fan in Arizona. And I'm so grateful for that experience. And you're right. Your recommendation is so specific to people, which I really loved about you. It wasn't just a like, yeah. Because the world feels very, in the world of writing, it feels very hard to break into. So the people who have made it so big and beautifully. And that's who you admired. Shonda and Elizabeth and Martha and
right. You know, first names.
Yeah. Oh, you only need to say their first names. And we're all like, oh my God. And being in your presence, it was this beautiful segue into this gorgeous world where you have one foot in and you have one foot in this place of, I do the work every single day. Let me try my writing on with you. And it was the first time I'd ever read anything I wrote out loud. It was the safety of that room. It was the beautifulness of all of it that I think just really helped. And I think you can do this anywhere, but I think it was the process of, it's all the stuff in the middle that makes things great that people don't see. And it's the multiple drafts when people rip your shit to shreds and you would like to punch them. It is the, it's the working and reworking and the suggestions and the late night edits and all of those things I desperately love, but I hated all at the same time. The only way I write, not the only way, but the way I write really well is by myself in somebody's basement or in a hotel room. No, I need like 48 hours. I got very connected to those white sheets, those big sheets of paper at the 60s. And then I put them all over and then I start to form it and I can move them. This has to go here. This has to go here. And then I talk it out. And one of the suggestions you made to me, and then also when you made me do the stupid book proposal, which took a lot of my time and was
which we have to talk about because I have no idea why did I make you do that? I wanted you to self-publish.
It's a phenomenal exercise.
Well, I know that, but you didn't have a lot of time. I still told you to do it.
You did. But Linda, it was brilliant because you also connected me to Rhonda, who you've spoke about already, when we're speaking about how do we sort of market this book as a self-publisher. And she was great because she had all these questions that you had made me answer in the book proposal, like who is the market? Who's doing the same things you are? Why would you be different or better than this person? What would the subtitle be? Really think about
your elevator speech, right? Who's your competition?
And so when I sat down with Rhonda, I was prepared for those things.
No kidding.
And I think that is the part that you could have an idea and some brilliance, but it really is that ability to work through some of the stuff to articulate it clearly because we are so full of dreams and ideas. And if people could just see it, it'd be so much easier. But the process of getting it out in a semblance of order that people resonate with takes so much practice. This is why I love being a speaker and an author. Because I try so much of what I put down on paper with people first. Kids These Days, for example, we've sold over almost 250,000 copies as a self-publisher.
Okay, now you need to say that slower. It's called Kids These Days. This was your first book. This was the self-published book that we decided that you should write at Carmel that then you launched and you sold. I was so grateful that you had self-published because didn't you sell like 20,000 copies in the first month when the average self-published book sells like 200, maybe in the first year?
Oh my God. Can I just tell you, I'm still so proud of it. We had a team of our moms and our kids and our husband schlep books. And we sold 4,300, I'll remember this number for the rest of my life, 4,333 pre-sale copies.
Holy
that was a suggestion
smokes.
You made. In order to pay for the first print run, you said sell pre-sales and offer them something. Like it will be signed and there will be a quote card in there. Because Brené, I have to talk about this. One of the times I saw Brené speak, she put this quote card in her book that's never available anywhere else. It's got tattered.
Like a little postcard.
And it says the best thing. And it's a quote that she doesn't use very many other places. And every time my team and I have a conversation about like an idea that we could do, I was like, do you guys remember? Do you know it'd be a really good idea? And they're always like, if you talk about Brené's quote card again, we're going to throw punch you. I'm like, but do you remember? Yes. So I did that and we sold 4,000 pre-sale copies and it paid for the first two runs of books.
Okay, so when you were on stage, did you say to the audiences, hey, I'm working on this book. Here's how to buy a pre-order copy. Is that how you did it? Or did you do it by email promotion? Or did you do it on social media or all of the above? How did you let them know they were going to get a signed copy with a quote card?
All of the above. I'm not very good at strategy. This has been maybe my biggest downfall as an entrepreneur, as I just shoot from the hip and hope for the fucker best. Who knows how she's going to turn out?
Right.
And the feedback that I get so often is, what is your strategy? What are you doing in Q1 and Q2? Fuck if I know. But for this particular run of things, it was like, do you believe that this message can change lives? And I said, I believe this message can save lives. That's how good I think it is. And they're like, well, have you ever bought anything that you weren't pitched before? Have you ever believed in something? I heard Jules Solomon say this the other day. She's like, I was pitched the first date with my husband. I was pitched the shirt I'm wearing. And if you truly believe in some of the things, then you have to be relentlessly able to do it. And I hated the idea because I was like, I don't want to be the schwarmy salesperson from the stage. It was like, for $19.99, I will sell my soul and give you a... I'm like, how do we... And that was where Rhonda was so brilliant because I was like, I would rather people just stumble upon this rather than get up there and go like, rush the stage and I'll give you $25 if no, not interested. The authenticity of the message needs to match the platform in which we're serving from, as does the message in the book. So how do we marry the two of those? And so we really talked about, like, do you believe this is something that can be life-saving? And I was like, yep. So we talked about on the stage, can you offer your soul, everything you know to be true as a psychologist, all of the in the trenches stories, and then say, listen, I put this together in a book because you've taught me so much. And we're going to launch this book February 14th. And you'd like a pre-sale copy, I would love to sign it for you. I would love to be able to give you the first sneak peek, and I would love for you to support me. And if you're up for it, my goodness, I promise you, this book is going to be something that'll change your life. And people did it.
Oh, I love that so much. Now, the reason I wanted you to meet with Rhonda is because Rhonda had had such a long career and continues to as a speaker. And a lot of people wonder, how do I get into speaking? What is your best advice for people who still haven't gotten on stages? Where do you start?
For me, it's interesting. I never intended to do this stuff. So psychologist, we moved to this small town because we had 3 kids in 2 years. And my husband was like, oh, wow, you are losing your mind. And he said, I know it'll help you. Let's move closer to my mother.
Oh.
Wow. So I wake up in this, I was drugged, and I wake up in this little and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I started to coach hockey. I started to practice. And then I started to consult with school divisions around really tough kids because I love the hitters, the kickers, the biters. Trauma is my background. Mm-hmm. I can talk about it all day long because it's so critically important to help people shift this understanding about it's not what is wrong with you. It's what happened to you. Bruce Perry wrote a book of the same title. I would show up in school divisions and I would have people say, we have never seen a kid like this. This is them. Oh my goodness. And would describe these kids as really horrific people. And I would see this group of staff that had just poured their heart and soul into this kid and just be really exhausted. And so we would start to conceptualize and tell the story and how trauma messes everything up. And I would see these light bulb moments of, okay, okay. And I could see what it took to get this staff back in the game and to shift the culture. And empathy is the prerequisite. It is knowing the context. All of a sudden, then you just exude this empathy that all of these caring people have. We've lost access to it.
As you point out so beautifully in the book, which I had no awareness of, we are not born with empathy. It has to be learned. It's like, what? What do you mean it has to be learned?
You can't give it away if you haven't received it.
Yeah. Wow.
And so the ones who need it the most are the hardest to give it to. And I think that when we can shore up the carers, I think we've made a really big mistake in the world of first responders and educators and those of us in emergency services, first responders, nurses, physicians. We get into this place of expecting us to be able to continue to serve the most dysregulated amongst us. But acknowledgement is the key to be able to fill them up so that we can continue to do this hard work. And we've never been so disconnected in the history of the free world. Never been this disconnected. And so you know that the system is broken because we're wired for connection. We're not compassion fatigued. We are wired to care for other people. All we need to know is we matter in this process. And one of my favorite hockey coaches said this, you'll love this quote, and it's in Feeling Seen too because I love it so much. He said, you should see how fast I can get a kid to skate when I know the name of his dog.
You put that towards the front of the book when I read that. I was like, this is the best quote I've ever heard, and I'm obsessed with this book.
Right? You just think about when somebody leans into your husband and they want to talk all horses or they want to talk all golfing and they want to know everything about the pedigree and how this happened. And people are just like, what? There needs to be a genuineness to it. People are so hard to hate close up, Linda. And that's the thing that I've learned so much in the last little bit is that we all started in exactly the same place, listening to the heartbeats of our mamas. And that is all we need in times of biggest distress is somebody to slow it down in that rhythmic exchange of, okay, 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 we got it. Because race is a social construct. And we have spent so much time trying to figure out why our differences matter, then really we're all wired to just know that we matter. And those who have experienced marginalization more than anybody, and this is ridiculous that as a white woman, I'm having this conversation. I have just unlearned and learned so much in the last 6 months and I'm not even start 6 years.
Oh, I know. I feel the same way. I've read so many books that are like the book Cast absolutely blew my mind. And I thought I knew so much. And then I thought, I don't know crap. And then even with your book, the way you describe colonialism, you describe it in a way that's so incredibly valuable and important. And then explains so much of why we are where we are all around the world right now. It just makes everything so much clearer. Talk to me about how you got on those first stages. What did you do? Were you talking anywhere that would have you? Were you knocking on doors?
So when I started to consult school divisions, my mother-in-law at the time was an educational assistant. So she worked in a school. And so she would come home here and say like, oh my gosh, this kid is a manipulative attention seeking liar. And I would be like, oh, okay, Lori, let's talk about that a little bit. Do you think I could come in maybe and I'll bring some snacks? And if you could get your team together, maybe even I'll start to chat to them about that. Would that be okay? And she's like, oh yeah, you bring snacks. We're there. So for many times, I would just offer to show up for free in church basements to talk about the neurophysiology of kids and trauma and what's happening and why this job is so hard and why the job is so holy and why you're so great to be able to be in this position. And ask me anything. Talk to me about being a psychologist. You want me to tell you what I'm thinking or what I know about kids? And
what was your motivation? Because you were making money in your practice. What was your motivation to go to a church basement? Was it need? You were seeing a need. You were seeing these administrators that were cooked and overwhelmed. Was that it?
That's such a good friggin' question. I think because I love it, I will talk to fucking anybody about trauma and grief and emotion and the mental health crisis and how to build a business and how to be a powerful woman and how to balance kids and life and family and how to fuck it all up and put it all together. I want to talk about business. I want to talk about ideas. That feeds my soul.
Yeah. And you were the person that people would call after a school shooting. Jody, please go talk to the kids. Go talk to the school administrators. You're that first responder who's going to the trauma places. Is that correct?
Yeah, I love it.
Okay. I know you love it. That's why we love you. Was it when you would go and you would see the things that you did that made a difference? Was that a drive? Like, okay, let me get on stages and talk to a whole bunch of people so that we can get to more people faster. Was that part of the drive?
Oh my gosh, it fills my soul. I just did this weekend in a little town called Lloydminster, Alberta. We had two sold out shows of 300 people each in a casino.
No.
Fancy. And it was so fantastic because you could see people laugh and cry and they just want to do better and be better. Mother Teresa talked about this. Your only job in this life is to cast a stone so that then that ripple effect becomes so great. And to have that ability to be able to do that is just so, it's such a fucking gift. And I think so many times it feels completely out of my control. We talked about this many times, you and I, where sometimes there's something bigger than you, I think. And I'm just so lucky. My husband is great with our children. Our parents have been so incredibly supportive. And we just had the biggest blow to our family. Aaron's mom died, just got ill before Christmas. We've lost her at 67. Oh. And it is just reminding me just how critically important it is to just dive in, to just jump in. If you have that opportunity, you take whatever you got on any given day and you just live big and loud because we have no idea how many heartbeats we have left. People are just watching. You can't tell them how to chase their dreams. You can't tell them how to be anti-racist or unlearn or be great. You have to show them. Yeah. And so I think in that showing, the fuck-upness and the losing your mind and not doing it right is the best part. And so I feel like this is the biggest privilege on the face of this planet to be able to do this work alongside a team that I adore, to be able to make money at it and do it beautifully. I don't even know how we got here. It's such
a... You know what's interesting? I'm just seeing a parallel between you and another author that I helped to self-publish. His name was Dr. Bobby Smith. He was a cop.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
He's passed away now. But
yes, that book he wrote is beautiful.
It was called The Will to Survive, a mental and emotional guide for law enforcement professionals and the people who love them. And what had happened with him is he loved being a cop more than anybody. I mean, just loved it. It was from Monroe, Louisiana. Hmm. And he was at a highway checkpoint looking for people on drugs and high on the freeway. And he was shot in the face by a cop killer. And he lived, but he was blind. And so he thought, how can I continue to share the messages that I was doing one-on-one on the beat? How can I do this with a bigger audience? And so he started speaking. And he was like you. You walk in, it's packed. People are laughing and crying within minutes. I was so blown away by his speaking style. It's so similar to yours. And he just would hypnotize the room. And he wanted to write a mass market book. He had been advised, and I have a question for you in this. He had been advised to write a mass market book because he was so charismatic like you. And I took one look at him and I said, but what's your bigger goal? I think when anybody's trying to decide between self-publishing or traditional publishing, between going mass market or going niche, you got to ask him, what's your end game? So for Bobby, what his end game was, he said, Linda, I want to change laws. I want to be a senator. I said, okay. Then starting with a self-help book, the 10 steps to this or that, is not going to do it, Bobby. I said, why don't we write the definitive Bible of law enforcement? And that got him excited. So we took that book. He self-published it. I actually got him a book deal, but then the publisher went bankrupt. It was so insane. So he self-published it. And then he made a fortune over the years as he spoke around the world selling that book. And it was just such a beautiful, beautiful experience. My question to you with him, the motivation to go into being a senator and changing laws, it was better to start with a niche topic. Own the niche, blow out that niche, and then you can go mass market with a different title. And you did the same thing. You started niche. Kids these days, who was it for? It was for educators?
Teachers and parents. Yeah, educators and parents.
Yeah. Okay. So obviously it could be mass market. And I think you've broken through the teacher sort of thing. And then you did teachers these days right after that.
Which is almost like a little bit even more niche-y.
Exactly. And then look what happens. Then your top five publisher comes to you and says, we want a book. And now you've got your mass market book.
I know. What? How did this even happen?
It happened because you're effing brilliant and because you took the right steps in the right order. And there is no one way to do this, guys.
Right.
I want to say for anybody
so true
this, oftentimes I'll say, write the book proposal and then shop it. Look for an agent. See if that agent can get you the book deal that you want, because then you don't have to learn all the self-publishing things on your own and you have a partner and it can be a faster way to do it. But not always. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, like you, you write the proposal first. Now you've got the blueprint. So if you don't want to go the agent route, you didn't take that time because you didn't really have a lot of time. So if you don't want to take the time or you don't have the time, maybe like Jody, you have a ton of speaking coming up and you have a built-in audience. If you decide to self-publish, you've got that blueprint. So I just wanted to clarify, there's no right way to do this. Everybody has a different path. But if you are a motivated creature and if you have a way to sell books on your own, if you've got a big email list or you're teaching workshops or you've got famous friends who are pitching you, whatever, self-publishing can be incredibly rewarding. Is there anything you would do differently now that you've been through this, what, five-year process?
No, to be honest with you, because I think there's so many things you learn along the way. There's so many things that we got the distributor. How do you sort of work percentages into those kind of things? What do you learn about Amazon? What do you learn about...
Did you do CreateSpace? Was it Amazon's CreateSpace that you self-published with?
To start, yeah. And then we got picked up by a little publisher after, and that's how we stayed with kids and teachers. And then HarperCollins came to us.
Yeah. How was that phone call? Was that exciting?
Oh my gosh. It was their senior editor, their marketing team. There was like four people on the call and I was so nervous. They were like, oh my gosh, we really watched the success of your first two books. And I was like, thank you so much. Oh my goodness. We're really looking for somebody to write a book that the whole world needs to sort of talk about relationship and connection and we just think you'd be a good fit. Would you be able to write a proposal? And I was like, let me check my schedule. It was the middle of the pandy. And I was like, and you know, you're not supposed to like look too eager.
Oh yeah.
I didn't, that wasn't my jam. No, I was like, okay, I already got the title. And they're like, oh, okay. Do you now? And so I was like, yeah, I think it could be like, acknowledge it or like, if you only knew. And so they're like, okay. So they're making notes and they're like, do you think you could write together a proposal for next Tuesday? And I was like, yes. So we pitched it and it was really short and sweet. That's all they really wanted at that point. And they were like, hey, we love it. We'll love it. We'll give you, what do you call it when they give you the thing ahead, like the bonus?
The advance.
Thank you. Oh my God, what is happening with me? I'm going to have a stroke.
You're busy. No, you're on a book tour, honey. You're busy.
Right. Got it. So they gave me an advance. It took me a year to write it. And last Christmas, I remember Christmas morning, I woke up at 4 before the babies got up because the first draft edits were due January 1st.
No.
And so I would put the babies to bed. And there's a picture of us driving back from my mom's, I think on Christmas Eve or Boxing Day or something. And I've got my feet up on the dashboard and I've got papers on the side where I'm editing and the kids are in the back. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, be quiet. Trying to figure out how to feel seen. Okay.
You know, shut up so I can feel seen.
You know I'm working here. Like, it's Christmas. I'm like, oh, I know.
Anyway,
but it was, I mean, the timing was great. They've been really, really lovely. It's a completely different experience. I feel like I've lost some control, which is sad. They wouldn't let me read the audiobook, which crushed my soul.
What?
I know.
What?
Get lots of conversations with them about that. And
what?
Yeah, I'm not big enough yet. They are concerned about procedure, policy, all those kind of things. And so I was like, okay, listen, here's my deal. If this goes big, then we need to re-release it with my voice because these are my words and these are my people. And they're like, we totally understand. Yes, yes, yes. So I don't know. So if you don't mind, could you go buy Feeling Seen and make it a New York Times bestseller? If you'd like to buy it for your entire audience and organization, I'd be very happy about that. So I could go back to HarperCollins and be like, listen, bitches, I really want to read my own words. So.
Okay, listen to this. I'm in the recording booth recently in Scottsdale doing Beautiful Writers. I had a contract where I said, if I don't get to read my own book, I'm not doing it. You don't get the audio. So we sold the audio rights at auction and they could only get them if I got to read the audio. And where I put my foot down, and you could have done that probably, you just didn't know. And I'm sorry we didn't talk about that ahead of time. But because you would have called their bluff, I'm guessing.
I said to my agent, I was like, can we walk away from this deal?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh my God, Joe. So anyway, I flew to Toronto. We met with the team. They were like, listen, we're so sorry, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know.
Well, I walked away from a different deal. No. And it was scary as hell to walk. I walked away from Simon & Schuster for Generation Green. And that was in 2007 or 2008 because they wouldn't publish it on recycled paper. And I said, sorry. So I inked recycled paper. I said, sorry, I'm not writing an environmental book for teenagers on regular paper. There is not going to be any sap on my hands. Sorry. And they said no. And we walked. And I said to my son, who was my co-author, I am so sorry, baby. And he goes, Mom, no, don't be sorry. Sure enough, they came back 3 weeks later and said, okay, you can have it. And I got what I wanted. But here's why I wanted to tell you this story. So I'm in the recording booth recently. And the guy who runs the studio is telling me about this author. He had recorded his first audiobook with the guy reading his own audiobook. He's a self-help guy. He's not as big as a Tony Robbins, but he's big. He has 4 successful self-help books.
Okay.
So he did his first narration for his first book. He did his second narration for his second book. On the third book, the book comes out and he's expecting to go into the recording booth and do the narration. Wasn't even stressed about it. One day he gets an alert from one of his friends. Dude, your audiobook is up. He goes, what are you talking about? I haven't done it yet. He goes and looks at it. The publisher had hired somebody else to read his book in his own voice, but it's not his voice. And here's where it made no damn sense. He's a successful author and had already done his first 2 books and they didn't even tell him. So audio is tricky, guys. You really have to be on top of stuff. I don't know what that is all about. I do know that when you do an audiobook, it is more a performance. It's more a performance than a reading. So oftentimes they will want an actor, and I get that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
As Mark Manson told me, more and more now, they're clear that the audience wants to hear the author, even if they're not as good as a pro. It was hard to say no to me when I have a podcast with my voice and the book is based on the podcast. If they had used somebody else's voice other than mine, I think it would have just been such a disconnect.
Yeah.
So you will prevail. Just keep on it. Your people love you. So that's crackers.
Whatever.
Okay. So we need to, everyone listening, you need to buy 17 copies of Feeling Seen. Let's make it a New York Times bestseller so that Jodi gets to read her own audiobook.
That would be freaking amazing. And then Mark Manson will pick up the book and he will hold it on his little thing and he will say,
in the Senate.
Yeah.
Did you see what happened with his book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck? Who was the senator that was, I forget her name right now, but she was holding
it. During all of that debacle on the floor, out of the speaker. I know. I was like, oh my gosh. Yes. Mark, buddy, you need feeling seen. That's what you need.
No kidding. I want to ask you about your courage. I feel like I have many times in my life just kind of flung myself out there with publishing. Pie in the sky, driven by a mission. My mission was environmental. And also to show some of those snotty, smarty pants, mean girls in high school that I was not the airhead that they declared that I was. We all have different motivations for why we do what we do. And I think as we start to have success, those motivations get cleaner and healthier and even more fulfilling. Talk to me about where your courage comes from. Have you had to bolster yourself or is it pretty natural to you?
There's three places. I think that courage is a constant work in progress because you never arrive. You never arrive at a relentless pursuit of like, I've got it. Now, I do these three things on the best days and on other days, I just drink wine. Okay. But if I were to pick three things that help me the most in this place, I've got to remember my people. I got to drop my shoulders and I got to remember the bigger picture, the why. So if I think about my people, and many people have talked about it in so many ways, but I think about it like you got to pick the people who know your soul. And there's not very many of those. For me, there's five and my husband makes the list. Sometimes he goes on and off depending on what we're talking about. But generally speaking, when people question my character, when I know that I've crossed a line, when I really regret something I've said or I've done, I often just need to get back to them. If I were standing at their feet, if I were asking for their opinion, how would they guide me through that? The definition for me is they have to make you belly laugh. They usually know your middle name. If a bra or makeup is required, they're not your people. If you've ever said, oh my God, they didn't invite me for dinner, not your people. They're a sacred few. And I tell the story, I think in Feeling Seen a little bit about one of my people, her name is Rhea. And we met in our second year of college. And I adore this woman. I've never belly laughed so hard in my life. We both took a long time to have babies. And so we gave each other's toast to the bride at the weddings and we rocked each other's babies to sleep. And I gave the eulogy at her funeral.
Whoa.
I know. 2.5 years ago, she lost her battle to cancer and she left those babies we waited so long for behind. Nevi was 4 and Lucan was 7. And I remember thinking this was just starting for me. And I was like, how am I going to do this without one of my people, the one who could kick me in the ass and be like, don't fucking swear today because you're really going to have to make some inroads. And I was like, now what do I do? And I was rereading Tuesdays with Maury by Mitch Albom. And he said, death ends a life, not a relationship.
Oh.
And I remember thinking,
oh God, that makes me cry.
Okay, Rhea, you are looking to be on this journey, whether you're here or not. And it was just the most profound experience for me because I think it's some of my most difficult moments on stage or the multiple rejections that you get from whoever, publishers, speaking requests. I remember thinking, that's who I got to get back to is, would she be okay with this? And I can't remember if I told you the story, but I met Liz Gilbert and she was my top five to be able to sit at the same table. Yeah. And she is as profound in person as she is, as you hope her to be. And I had an opportunity, we spoke, we had dinner and we did all these things. And I had an opportunity to go back after she'd watched me speak, to speak to her. And you know what? The only person I wanted to get back to was Rhea. And instead of going and having dinner and thanking Liz, I went up to the hotel room and went out on the balcony and I was like, did you see that? Because they're the ones we want to get back to.
Oh, baby.
That's how you define your people. And those are the ones I think mostly that remind me where the courage is. It's our ancestors. Maya Angelou, in the prerequisite, started giving Clinton's second inauguration speech. She said, I never feel alone on stage because my ancestors are always with me. That's where, for me, even I started on third base, as Glennon has talked about, and I often try so hard not to take for granted how easy it was for me to start here. And I try to remember that it is the legacy for so many people, including my daughter and my sons, but the many women who have come before me that were remarkable human beings that I'm like, okay, fuck it, let's go.
So that's
number one, courage, I think, is the biggest issue from your people. The second is where I'm at my best is when I drop my shoulders. If I'm ever doubting myself, I promise you my shoulders are around my ears. Oh my God, holy fuck, what are they going to say? Oh my God, they're going to pull the book. Obviously, it's all going to be news channels. I'm an idiot. Jesus, forget it. Fuck it. We're dead. Obviously, it's going to lose their job. We're now going to be in receivership. Oh, please, I can't go online ever. Whenever I'm in that place, these are here. So there's a massive neurophysiological connection, obviously, between your heart and your soul and your mind. And we know this to be true. Moving your body, drinking your water, all of those things. But you can drink all the fucking kale you want if you do not understand the importance of really reconnecting your head and your heart. It becomes very difficult to continue to serve. So I often think about this. Drop your shoulders. Relax your jaw. Drop your tongue from the roof of your mouth. It's a very primitive response. You slam that tongue to the roof of your mouth when you get really stressed. So you drop that. And you wiggle your toes. And you smile. And you let your gut out. That's a relaxed body. And if I'm going to make some of the best decisions of my life, I will do it when I'm in that state. It's often when I remind myself of this, I have a little sticky note, drop your shoulders. Sometimes I put a reminder on my phone. So as we step off into this book tour here, this next 3 months, there's a reminder on my phone that goes off every day. Nobody else knows what it means. Just drop your shoulders, which drops my cortisol, increases the oxytocin, the dopamine, and I'm then better able to serve my people. Because back to that number one, that's who matters the most. This is a job. This is such a privilege. This is so much fun. It's a job. I'm replaceable. There's 50 other fucking authors waiting to say the thing that I'm saying. So those who I go home to at night matter most. And then the third thing for me is really this why. So Simon Sinek started talking about start with why. One of my favorites right now talks about walking your why. Susan David is a psychologist, a fellow psychologist, and I love her work. She talks about walking it. So don't just fucking start with it, but walk it. And I love this idea of sort of stepping into that bigger picture. And for me, the why is always best summed by a Ram Dass quote that I keep over my shoulder every time I put it in Healing Scene 2. He said, we're all just here walking each other home.
I was thinking about that quote that you repeat so often, which I love. I was thinking about that this weekend. I had a bunch of stuff to do for my book this weekend. I had podcasts and things to record. No, because I get a phone call. My sister calls and says, my 18-year-old dog is dying. It's going to be a week, but she's devastated. And I said, okay, I'm getting on a flight. She said, no. It's going to be a little while. I know you have so much going on. Let's just stay in touch. I said, okay. Then I see on social media that one of my dearest friends in Los Angeles, also where my sister lives, her barn burned down. Part of her barn burned down. A couple of horses were lost. The story is too excruciating to even talk about right now, but I saw that people were going. They were going to go help clean up. And I booked a flight. I just thought, my people, yeah, that's going to slow down some PR stuff I'm doing. And that doesn't matter. What I love so much about your new book, Feeling Seen, and I want to talk more about the self-publishing for people who are in that in a minute. But what I love so much is this idea that we just all need each other so much. And when I got to the barn, Carrie, who owns the barn, I haven't seen her in a long time. We stay in touch all the time, but I haven't seen her. She was making things happen and telling the wheelbarrows where to go and take the chainsaws here. And she takes one look at me and we both just start crying because I saw her. She saw me. That's all we needed was just to be seen. It didn't even matter if I helped. I did, yeah, of course. But that wasn't the point. The point was showing up.
Absolutely.
And it just filled me up so much. And I came home, I'm absolutely exhausted. And I have a to-do list out the wazoo. And it doesn't matter because my heart is full. The work will get done.
Yeah. Yeah. It puts it in perspective, doesn't it? And I often say this, particularly in times of grief, just go. Historically, yes. If you think about in our grandparents' generation, somebody dies up the road, the first thing you do is you take food, all the gluten, despite the fact that you didn't worry if there's a fucking gluten allergy.
I ate so much gluten this weekend.
And you go up there and I often ask this question, where were the kids in those days? And the interesting thing is they were at our feet.
The kids were all over the barn. There must have been, there were probably 100 of us there yesterday. And there were kids everywhere and they were on bicycles and they were in wagons and they were helping and they were running and they were laughing and they were playing and they were crying. I thought of your work. I thought of how you teach this. They were
you can't
learning about grief and learning about showing up and learning about being together in love.
Yeah. It's amazing. It might not ever be the right time. No act of service is ever lost. And even if in the moment you show up and it's not the right time, you just leave your lasagna on the front step, I promise you, they will not forget it. I think sometimes we doubt all the time. Should we send an emoji? Should we check on Facebook and see how people... Social media is so lovely in so many ways, but it really isn't social. It really prevents us from wanting to step on toes or think we know things based on images that people are presenting. And I think so many times, historically, we just go. We would just figure that out. And it's the proximity to one another that we will never automate. And whenever you got a chance, take it, because it is just so critical. So I'm so proud of you. I'm so glad you went. She will never forget that moment, and neither will you.
No, it was just astounding.
I keep thinking about all of the people in the world that are coming to me now. How are you a writer? How did you become a writer? And every time I always direct into your podcast, and I think that's the piece. Yeah. Mm,
thank you, baby. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, I love you so much. I love you so much.
Thank you. I'm so glad we got to do this. And it really, I know this is a big jump for you to have one of your people who hasn't really done much, but I so appreciate it so much.
I think doing a self-publishing episode is going to be so valuable. So valuable. I'm so grateful.
Thank you, baby. Okay. Mwah. Take care of you. All of those big emotions. Take care of you. And we'll see you soon in New York in March. Bye.
Oh my God. Love it. Okay. Bye, baby.
Jodi and I don't really expect you to buy 17 copies of Feeling Seen to help her hit the New York Times list in order to get that audiobook re-recorded. But before we close, I want to talk about book sales. As you no doubt know, those bestseller lists take their numbers from tens of thousands of brick-and-mortar bookstores, plus online retailers. But when you're a speaker like Jodi, who did 190 dates last year, you're looking at tens of thousands of book orders fulfilled directly through her publisher, which don't report to the lists. Special bulk or group sales and book club orders aren't reported either. Same with books ordered through an author's website. This means that week after week, month after month, you can be selling more books than authors at the top of those bestseller lists, and no one would know, say by your Amazon ranking. So, buy your copies of Feeling Seen, Kids These Days, or Teachers These Days via your favorite store or online retailer. But do take a visit to drjodicarrington.com if you'd like to bring her in for a keynote or workshop, or you're an educator or parent and want to download one of her incredible courses. Oh, and FYI, Jodi, I was just on your website checking out your wares, and looky here what I found. A gratitude journal in your shop. It's beautiful. You say, and I quote, "Tear out the note and give it to them, or send it up and out into the universe. Burning can be quite effective." Who's burning shit now, Alberta sister? Too funny. As always, thanks to Kevin at Red Room Sound and Julia McPherson at Innerspace Marketing, and to you for listening. I know your time is valuable, and there are a bajillion podcasts to choose from these days. Stay tuned for incredible guests coming soon, and be sure to subscribe so you'll be the first to know when I drop a new episode. You may have noticed I'm no longer on a schedule. It's more important to me to take my time with each interview to create something you'll truly treasure than to crank these out. Hence, why subscribing is a win-win for us both. At least for now, I still prefer to do these shows without advertisers. So your 5 stars and love notes make all the difference to the algorithm gods. Obviously, only if you mean it. Lastly, if you love the show, I think you'll love the book even more. Check out Beautiful Writers, A Journey of Big Dreams and Messy Manuscripts, with tricks of the trade from best-selling authors, for the very best from years of these interviews. I weave those topics into this coming-of-career writing memoir that reads like a beach read, say others. I swear, check out my blurbs. Truly, the book is packed with details I wish I'd known when I was starting out, and also things that career authors love hearing from their peers. Okay, beautiful. Big, big hugs. Until next time, right on.